surprisingly, since such episodes have never been known to happen in the same place twice. As far as we know, they are as random as lightning. The next one could be under Chicago, or Paris, or Kinshasa. No one can even begin to guess. And what causes these massive intraplate rupturings? Something deep within the earth. More than that, we don't know. By the 1960s, scientists had grown sufficiently frustrated by how little they understood of the Earth's interior that they decided to try to do something about it. Specifically, they got the idea to drill through the ocean floor, the continental crust was too thick, to the Moho discontinuity, and to extract a piece of the Earth's mantle for examination at leisure. The thinking was that if they could understand the nature of the rocks inside the Earth, they might begin to understand how they interacted, and thus possibly be able to predict earthquakes and other unwelcome events. The project became known, all but inevitably, as the Mohole, and it was pretty well disastrous. The hope was to lower a drill through 14,000 feet of Pacific Ocean water off the coast of Mexico, and drill some 17,000 feet through relatively thin crustal rock. Drilling from a ship in open water is, in the words of one oceanographer, like trying to drill a hole in the sidewalks of New York from atop the Empire State Building using a strand of spaghetti. Every attempt ended in failure. The deepest they penetrated was only about 600 feet. The Mohole became known as the No-Hole. In 1966, exasperated with ever-rising costs and no results, Congress killed the project. 4 years later, Soviet scientists decided to try their luck on dry land. They chose a spot on Russia's Kola Peninsula, near the Finnish border, and set to work with the hope of drilling to a depth of 15 kilometres. The work proved harder than expected, but the Soviets were commendably persistent. When at last they gave up, 19 years later, they had drilled to a depth of 12,262 metres, or about 7.6 miles. Bearing in mind that the crust of the Earth represents only about 0.3% of the planet's volume, and that the Kola hole had not cut even one-third of the way through the crust, we can hardly claim to have conquered the interior. Interestingly, even though the hole was modest, nearly everything about it was surprising. Seismic wave studies had led the scientists to predict, and pretty confidently, that they would encounter sedimentary rock to a depth of 4,700 metres, followed by granite for the next 2,300 metres, and basalt from there on down. In the event, the sedimentary layer was 50% deeper than expected, and the basaltic layer was never found at all. Moreover, the world down there was far warmer than anyone had expected, with a temperature at 10,000 metres of 180 degrees centigrade, nearly twice the forecasted level. Most surprising of all was that the rock at that depth was saturated with water, something that had not been thought possible. Because we can't see into the Earth, we have to use other techniques, which mostly involve reading waves as they travel through the interior. We also know a little bit about the mantle from what are known as kimberlite pipes, where diamonds are formed. What happens is that deep in the Earth there is an explosion that fires, in effect, a cannonball of magma to the surface at supersonic speeds. It is a totally random event. A kimberlite pipe could explode in your backyard as you read this. Because they come up from such depths, up to 120 miles down, kimberlite pipes bring up all kinds of things not normally found on or near the surface. A rock called peridotite, crystals of olivine, and, just occasionally, in about one pipe in 100, diamonds. Lots of carbon comes up with kimberlite ejecta, but most is vaporized or turns to graphite. Only occasionally does a hunk of it shoot up at just the right speed and cool down with the necessary swiftness to become a diamond. It was such a pipe that made Johannesburg the most productive diamond mining city in the world, but there may be others even bigger that we don't know about. Geologists know that somewhere in the vicinity of northeastern Indiana there is evidence of a pipe or group of pipes that may be truly colossal. Diamonds up to 20 carats or more have been found at scattered sites throughout the region, but no one has ever found the source. As John McPhee notes, It may be buried under glacially deposited soil like the Manson crater in Iowa, or under the Great Lakes. So how much do we know about what's inside the Earth? Very little. Scientists are generally agreed that the world beneath us is composed of four layers: rocky outer crust, a mantle of hot, viscous rock, a liquid outer core, and a solid inner core. We know that the surface is dominated by silicates, which are relatively light and not heavy enough to account for the planet's overall density. Therefore, there must be heavier stuff inside. We know that to generate our magnetic field somewhere in the interior, there must be a concentrated belt of metallic elements in a liquid state. That much is universally agreed upon. Almost everything beyond that, how the layers interact, what causes them to behave in the way they do, what they will do at any time in the future, is a matter of at least some uncertainty, and generally quite a lot of uncertainty. Even the one part of it we can see, the crust, is a matter of some fairly strident debate. Nearly all geology texts tell you that continental crust is 3 to 6 miles thick under the oceans, about 25 miles thick under the continents, and 40 to 60 miles thick under big mountain chains. But there are many puzzling variabilities within these generalizations. The crust beneath the Sierra Nevada mountains, for instance, is only about 19 to 25 miles thick, and no one knows why. By all the laws of geophysics, the Sierra Nevadas should be sinking as if into quicksand. Some people think they may be. How and when the Earth got its crust are questions that divide geologists into two broad camps: those who think it happened abruptly, early in the Earth's history, and those who think it happened gradually and rather later. Strength of feeling runs deep on such matters. Richard Armstrong of Yale proposed an early burst theory in the 1960s, then spent the rest of his career fighting those who did not agree with him. He died of cancer in 1991, but shortly before his death he lashed out at his critics in a polemic in an Australian earth science journal that charged them with perpetuating myths, according to a report in Earth magazine in 1998. "He died a bitter man," reported a colleague. The crust and part of the outer mantle together are called the lithosphere, from the Greek lithos, meaning stone, which in turn floats on top of a layer of softer rock called the asthenosphere, from Greek words meaning without strength. But such terms are never entirely satisfactory. To say that the lithosphere floats on top of the asthenosphere suggests a degree of easy buoyancy that isn't quite right. Similarly, it is misleading to think of the rocks as flowing in anything like the way we think of materials flowing on the surface. The rocks are viscous, but only in the same way that glass is. It may not look it, but all the glass on Earth is flowing downward, under the relentless drag of gravity. Remove a pane of really old glass from the window of a European cathedral, and it will be noticeably thicker at the bottom than at the top. That is the sort of flow we are talking about. The hour hand on a clock moves about 10,000 times faster than the flowing rocks of the mantle. The movements occur not just laterally as the Earth's plates move across the surface, but up and down as well, as rocks rise and fall under the churning process known as convection. Convection as a process was first deduced by the eccentric Count von Rumford at the end of the 18th century. 60 years later, an English vicar named Osmond Fisher presciently suggested that the Earth's interior might well be fluid enough for the contents to move about, but that idea took a very long time to gain support. In about 1970, when geophysicists realized just how much turmoil was going on down there, it came as a considerable shock. As Shauna Vogel put it in the book Naked Earth, The New Geophysics, it was as if scientists had spent decades figuring out the layers of the Earth's atmosphere, troposphere, stratosphere, and so forth, and then had suddenly found out about wind. How deep the convection process goes has been a matter of controversy ever since. Some say it begins 400 miles down, others 2,000 miles below us. The problem, as Donald Trefoil has observed, is that there are two sets of data from two different disciplines that cannot be reconciled. Geochemists say that certain elements on Earth's surface cannot have come from the upper mantle, but must have come from deeper within the Earth. Therefore the materials in the upper and lower mantle must at least occasionally mix. Seismologists insist that there is no evidence to support such a thesis. So all that can be said is that at some slightly indeterminate point as we head toward the center of the Earth, we leave the asthenosphere and plunge into pure mantle. Considering that it accounts for 82% of the Earth's volume and 65% of its mass, the mantle doesn't attract a great deal of attention, largely because the things that interest Earth scientists and general readers alike happen either deeper down, as with magnetism, or nearer the surface, as with earthquakes. We know that to a depth of about 100 miles, the mantle consists predominantly of a type of rock known as peridotite. But what fills the space beyond is uncertain. According to a Nature report, it seems not to be peridotite. More than this, we do not know. Beneath the mantle are the two cores, a solid inner core and a liquid outer one. Needless to say, our understanding of the nature of these cores is indirect, but scientists can make some reasonable assumptions. They know that the pressures at the center of the Earth are sufficiently high, something over 3 million times those found at the surface, to turn any rock there solid. They also know from Earth's history, among other clues, that the inner core is very good at retaining its heat. Although it is little more than a guess, it is thought that in over 4 billion years, the temperature at the core has fallen by no more than 200 degrees Fahrenheit. No one knows exactly how hot the Earth's core is, but estimates range from something over 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit to 13,000 degrees Fahrenheit, about as hot as the surface of the sun. The outer core is in many ways even less well understood, though everyone is in agreement that it is fluid and that it is the seat of magnetism. The theory was put forward by E.C. Bullard of Cambridge University in 1949 that this fluid part of the Earth's core revolves in a way that makes it, in effect, an electrical motor, creating the Earth's magnetic field. The assumption is that the convecting fluids in the Earth act somehow like the currents in wires. Exactly what happens isn't known, but it is felt pretty certain that it is connected with the core spinning and with its being liquid. Bodies that don't have a liquid core, the Moon and Mars, for instance, don't have magnetism. We know that Earth's magnetic field changes in power from time to time. During the age of the dinosaurs, it was up to 3 times as strong as now. We also know that it reverses itself every 500,000 years or so, on average, though that average hides a huge degree of unpredictability. The last reversal was about 750,000 years ago. Sometimes it stays put for millions of years. 37 million years appears to be the longest stretch, and at other times it has reversed after as little as 20,000 years. Altogether, in the last 100 million years, it has reversed itself about 200 times, and we don't have any real idea why. It has been called the greatest unanswered question in the geological sciences. We may be going through a reversal now. The Earth's magnetic field has diminished by perhaps as much as 6% in the last century alone. Any diminution in magnetism is likely to be bad news, because magnetism, apart from holding notes to refrigerators and keeping our compasses pointing the right way, plays a vital role in keeping us alive. Space is full of dangerous cosmic rays that, in the absence of magnetic protection, would tear through our bodies, leaving much of our DNA in useless tatters. When the magnetic field is working, these rays are safely herded away from the Earth's surface and into 2 zones in near space called the Van Allen belts. They also interact with particles in the upper atmosphere to create the bewitching veils of light known as the auroras. A big part of the reason for our ignorance, interestingly enough, is that traditionally there has been little effort to coordinate what's happening on top of the Earth with what's going on inside. According to Shauna Vogel, geologists and geophysicists rarely go to the same meetings or collaborate on the same problems. Perhaps nothing better demonstrates our inadequate grasp of the dynamics of the Earth's interior than how badly we are caught out when it acts up. And it would be hard to come up with a more salutary reminder of the limitations of our understanding than the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington in 1980. At the time, the lower 48 United States had not seen a volcanic eruption for over 65 years, Therefore, the government volcanologists called in to monitor and forecast St. Helens' behaviour primarily had seen only Hawaiian volcanoes in action, and they, it turned out, were not the same thing at all. St. Helens started its ominous rumblings on March the 20th. Within a week, it was erupting magma, albeit in modest amounts, up to 100 times a day, and being constantly shaken with earthquakes. People were evacuated to what was assumed to be a safe distance of 8 miles. As the mountain's rumblings grew, St. Helens became a tourist attraction for the world. Newspapers gave daily reports on the best places to get a view. Television crews repeatedly flew in helicopters to the summit, and people were even seen climbing over the mountain. On one day, more than 70 copters and light aircraft circled the summit. But as the days passed and the rumblings failed to develop into anything dramatic, people grew restless, and the view became general that the volcano wasn't going to blow after all. On April the 19th, the northern flank of the mountain began to bulge conspicuously. Remarkably, no one in a position of responsibility saw that this strongly signalled a lateral blast. The seismologists resolutely based their conclusions on the behaviour of Hawaiian volcanoes, which don't blow out sideways. Almost the only person who believed that something really bad might happen was Jack Hyde, a geology professor at a community college in Tacoma. He pointed out that St. Helens didn't have an open vent, as Hawaiian volcanoes have, so any pressure building up inside was bound to be released dramatically, and probably catastrophically. However, Hyde was not part of the official team, and his observations attracted little notice. We all know what happened next. At 8:32 a.m. on a Sunday morning, May the 18th, the north side of the volcano collapsed, sending an enormous avalanche of dirt and rock rushing down the mountain slope at 150 miles an hour. It was the biggest landslide in human history, and carried enough material to bury the whole of Manhattan to a depth of 400 feet. A minute later, its flank severely weakened, St. Helens exploded with a force of 500 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs, shooting out a murderous hot cloud at up to 650 miles an hour. Much too fast, clearly, for anyone nearby to outrace. Many people who were thought to be in safe areas, often far out of sight of the volcano, were overtaken. 57 people were killed. 23 of the bodies were never found. The toll would have been much higher, except that it was a Sunday. Had it been a weekday, many lumber workers would have been working within the death zone. As it was, people were killed 18 miles away. The luckiest person on that day was a graduate student named Harry Glicken. He had been manning an observation post 5.7 miles from the mountain, but he had a college placement interview on May the 18th in California, and so he had left the site the day before the eruption. His place was taken by David Johnston. Johnston was the first to report the volcano exploding. Moments later, he was dead. His body was never found. Glicken's luck, alas, was temporary. 11 years later, he was one of 43 scientists and journalists fatally caught up in a lethal outpouring of superheated ash, gases, and molten rock, what is known as a pyroclastic flow, at Mount Unzen in Japan, when yet another volcano was catastrophically misread. Volcanologists may or may not be the worst scientists in the world at making predictions, but they are without question the worst in the world at realizing how bad their predictions are. Less than 2 years after the Unzen catastrophe, another group of volcano watchers, led by Stanley Williams of the University of Arizona, descended into the rim of an active volcano called Galeras in Colombia. Despite the deaths of recent years, only 2 of the 16 members of Williams' party wore safety helmets or other protective gear. The volcano erupted, killing 6 of the scientists, along with 3 tourists who had followed them, and seriously injuring several others, including Williams himself. In an extraordinarily unself-critical book called Surviving Galeras, Williams said he could only shake my head in wonder when he learned afterward that his colleagues in the world of volcanology had suggested that he had overlooked or disregarded important seismic signals and behaved recklessly. How easy it is to snipe after the fact, to apply the knowledge we have now to the events of 1993, he wrote. He was guilty of nothing worse, he believed, than unlucky timing, when Galerus behaved capriciously, as natural forces are wont to do. I was fooled, and for that I will take responsibility. But I do not feel guilty about the deaths of my colleagues. There is no guilt. There was only an eruption. But to return to Washington. Mount St. Helens lost 1,300 feet of peak, and 230 square miles of forest were devastated. Enough trees to build 150,000 homes, or 300,000 in some reports, were blown away. The damage was placed at $2.7 billion. A giant column of smoke and ash rose to a height of 60,000 feet in less than 10 minutes. An airliner some 30 miles away reported being pelted with rocks. 90 minutes after the blast, ash began to rain down on Yakima, Washington, a community of 50,000 people about 80 miles away. As you would expect, the ash turned day to night and got into everything, clogging motors, generators, and electrical switching equipment, choking pedestrians, blocking filtration systems, and generally bringing things to a halt. The airport shut down, and highways in and out of the city were closed. All this was happening, you will note, just downwind of a volcano that had been rumbling menacingly for 2 months. Yet Yakima had no volcano emergency procedures. The city's emergency broadcast system, which was supposed to swing into action during a crisis, did not go on the air because the Sunday morning staff did not know how to operate the equipment. For 3 days, Yakima was paralyzed and cut off from the world, its airport closed, its approach roads impassable. Altogether, the city received just 5/8 of an inch of ash after the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Now bear that in mind, please, as we consider what a Yellowstone blast would do. XV. Dangerous Beauty. In the 1960s, while studying the volcanic history of Yellowstone National Park, Bob Christensen of the United States Geological Survey became puzzled about something that, oddly, had not troubled anyone before. He couldn't find the park's volcano. It had been known for a long time that Yellowstone was volcanic in nature. That's what accounted for all its geysers and other steamy features, and the one thing about volcanoes is that they are generally pretty conspicuous. But Christensen couldn't find the Yellowstone volcano anywhere. In particular, what he couldn't find was a structure known as a caldera. Most of us, when we think of volcanoes, think of the classic cone shapes of a Fuji or Kilimanjaro, which are created when erupting magma accumulates in a symmetrical mound. These can form remarkably quickly. In 1943, at Paricutin in Mexico, a farmer was startled to see smoke rising from a patch of his land. In 1 week, he was the bemused owner of a cone 500 feet high. Within 2 years, it had topped out at almost 1,400 feet and was more than half a mile across. Altogether, there are some 10,000 of these intrusively visible volcanoes on Earth, all but a few hundred of them extinct. But there is a second, less celebrated type of volcano that doesn't involve mountain building. These are volcanoes so explosive that they burst open in a single mighty rupture, leaving behind a vast subsided pit, the caldera, from a Latin word for cauldron. Yellowstone, obviously, was of this second type, but Christensen couldn't find the caldera anywhere. By coincidence, just at this time, NASA decided to test some new high-altitude cameras by taking photographs of Yellowstone, copies of which some thoughtful official passed on to the park authorities, on the assumption that they might make a nice blow-up for one of the visitors' centres. As soon as Christensen saw the photos, he realized why he had failed to spot the caldera. Virtually the whole park, 2.2 million acres, was caldera. The explosion had left a crater more than 40 miles across, much too huge to be perceived from anywhere at ground level. At some time in the past, Yellowstone must have blown up with a violence far beyond the scale of anything known to humans. Yellowstone, it turns out, is a supervolcano. It sits on top of an enormous hot spot, a reservoir of molten rock that rises from at least 125 miles down in the earth. The heat from the hot spot is what powers all of Yellowstone's vents, geysers, hot springs, and popping mud pots. Beneath the surface is a magma chamber that is about 45 miles across, roughly the same dimensions as the park, and about 8 miles thick at its thickest point. Imagine a pile of TNT about the size of Rhode Island and reaching 8 miles into the sky, to about the height of the highest cirrus clouds, and you have some idea of what visitors to Yellowstone are shuffling around on top of. The pressure that such a pool of magma exerts on the crust above has lifted Yellowstone and about 300 miles of surrounding territory about 1,700 feet higher than they would otherwise be. If it blew, the cataclysm is pretty well beyond imagining. According to Professor Bill Maguire of University College London, you wouldn't be able to get within 1,000 kilometres of it while it was erupting. The consequences that followed would be even worse. Superplumes of the type on which Yellowstone sits are rather like martini glasses, thin on the way up, but spreading out as they near the surface to create vast bowls of unstable magma. Some of these bowls can be up to 1,200 miles across. According to theories, they don't always erupt explosively, but sometimes burst forth in a vast continuous outpouring, a flood of molten rock, such as with the Deccan Traps in India 65 million years ago. Trap, in this context, comes from a Swedish word for a type of lava. Deccan is simply an area. These covered an area of 200,000 square miles, and probably contributed to the demise of the dinosaurs, they certainly didn't help, with their noxious outgassings. Superplumes may also be responsible for the rifts that cause continents to break up. Such plumes are not all that rare. There are about 30 active ones on the Earth at the moment, and they are responsible for many of the world's best-known islands and island chains. Iceland, Hawaii, the Azores, Canaries, and Galapagos archipelagos, little Pitcairn in the middle of the South Pacific, and many others. But apart from Yellowstone, they are all oceanic. No one has the faintest idea how or why Yellowstone's ended up beneath a continental plate. Only two things are certain, that the crust at Yellowstone is thin, and that the world beneath it is hot. But whether the crust is thin because of the hot spot, or whether the hot spot is there because the crust is thin, is a matter of heated, as it were, debate. The continental nature of the crust makes a huge difference to its eruptions. Where other supervolcanoes tend to bubble away steadily, and in a comparatively benign fashion, Yellowstone blows explosively. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, you want to stand well back. Since its first known eruption 16.5 million years ago, it has blown up about 100 times. But the most recent three eruptions are the ones that get written about. The last eruption was 1,000 times greater than that of Mount St. Helens. The one before that was 280 times bigger. And the one before that was so big that nobody knows exactly how big it was. It was at least 2,500 times greater than St. Helens, but perhaps 8,000 times more monstrous. We have absolutely nothing to compare it to. The biggest blast in recent times was that of Krakatoa in Indonesia in August 1883, which made a bang that reverberated around the world for 9 days and made water slosh as far away as the English Channel. But if you imagine the volume of ejected material from Krakatoa as being about the size of a golf ball, then the biggest of the Yellowstone blasts would be the size of a sphere you could just about hide behind. On this scale, Mount St. Helens would be no more than a pea. The Yellowstone eruption of 2 million years ago put out enough ash to bury New York State to a depth of 67 feet, or California to a depth of 20. This was the ash that made Mike Voorhees' fossil beds in eastern Nebraska. That blast occurred in what is now Idaho, but over millions of years, at a rate of about 1 inch a year, the Earth's crust has travelled over it, so that today it is directly under northwest Wyoming. The hot spot itself stays in one place, like an acetylene torch aimed at a ceiling. In its wake it leaves the sort of rich volcanic plains that are ideal for growing potatoes, as Idaho's farmers long ago discovered. In another 2 million years, geologists like to joke, Yellowstone will be producing French fries for McDonald's, and the people of Billings, Montana, will be stepping around geysers. The ash fall from the last Yellowstone eruption covered all or parts of 19 western states, plus parts of Canada and Mexico, nearly the whole of the United States west of the Mississippi. This, bear in mind, is the breadbasket of America, an area that produces roughly half the world's cereals. And ash, it is worth remembering, is not like a big snowfall that will melt in the spring. If you wanted to grow crops again, you would have to find some place to put all the ash. It took thousands of workers 8 months to clear 1.8 billion tons of debris from the 16 acres of the World Trade Center site in New York. Imagine what it would take to clear Kansas. And that's not even to consider the climatic consequences. The last supervolcano eruption on Earth was at Toba in northern Sumatra 74,000 years ago. No one knows quite how big it was, other than that it was a whopper. Greenland ice cores show that the Toba blast was followed by at least 6 years of volcanic winter, and goodness knows how many poor growing seasons after that. The event, it is thought, may have carried humans right to the brink of extinction, reducing the global population to no more than a few thousand individuals. That means that all modern humans arose from a very small population base, which would explain our lack of genetic diversity. At all events, there is some evidence to suggest that for the next 20,000 years, the total number of people on Earth was never more than a few thousand at any time. That is, needless to say, a long time to recover from a single volcanic blast. All this was hypothetically interesting until 1973, when an odd occurrence made it suddenly momentous. Water in Yellowstone Lake, in the heart of the park, began to run over the banks at the lake's southern end, flooding a meadow, while at the opposite end of the lake the water mysteriously flowed away. Geologists did a hasty survey and discovered that a large area of the park had developed an ominous bulge. This was lifting up one end of the lake and causing the water to run out at the other, as would happen if you lifted one side of a child's wading pool. By 1984, the whole central region of the park, several dozen square miles, was more than 3 feet higher than it had been in 1924, when the park was last formally surveyed. Then, in 1985, the whole of the central part of the park subsided by 8 inches. It now seems to be swelling again. The geologists realized that only one thing could cause this, a restless magma chamber. Yellowstone wasn't the site of an ancient supervolcano. It was the site of an active one. It was also at about this time that they were able to work out that the cycle of Yellowstone's eruptions averaged one massive blow every 600,000 years. The last one, interestingly enough, was 630,000 years ago. Yellowstone, it appears, is due. It may not feel like it, but you're standing on the largest active volcano in the world. Paul Doss, Yellowstone National Park geologist, told me soon after climbing off an enormous Harley-Davidson motorcycle and shaking hands when we met at the park headquarters at Mammoth Hot Springs early on a lovely morning in June. A native of Indiana, Doss is an amiable, soft-spoken, extremely thoughtful man who looks nothing like a National Park Service employee. He has a graying beard and hair tied back in a long ponytail. A small sapphire stud graces one ear. A slight paunch strains against his crisp Park Service uniform. He looks more like a blues musician than a government employee. In fact, he is a blues musician, harmonica, but he sure knows and loves geology. "And I've got the best place in the world to do it," he says, as we set off in a bouncy, battered four-wheel drive vehicle in the general direction of Old Faithful. He has agreed to let me accompany him for a day as he goes about doing whatever it is a park geologist does. The first assignment today is to give an introductory talk to a new crop of tour guides. Yellowstone, I hardly need point out, is sensationally beautiful, with plump, stately mountains, bison-specked meadows, tumbling streams, a sky-blue lake, wildlife beyond counting. "It really doesn't get any better than this if you're a geologist," Doss says. "You've got rocks up at Bear Tooth Gap that are nearly 3 billion years old, three-quarters of the way back to Earth's beginning. And then you've got mineral springs here," he points at the sulphurous hot springs from which Mammoth takes its title, "where you can see rocks as they're being born. And in between there's everything you could possibly imagine. I've never been any place where geology is more evident or prettier." "So you like it?" I say. "Oh, no. I love it, he answers with profound sincerity. I mean, I really love it here. The winters are tough, and the pay's not too hot, but when it's good, it's just... He interrupted himself to point out a distant gap in a range of mountains to the west, which had just come into view over a rise. The mountains, he told me, were known as the Gallatins. That gap is 60 or maybe 70 miles across. For a long time, nobody could understand why that gap was there, and then Bob Christensen realized that it had to be because the mountains were just blown away. When you've got 60 miles of mountains just obliterated, you know you're dealing with something pretty potent. It took Christensen 6 years to figure it all out. I asked him what caused Yellowstone to blow when it did. Don't know. Nobody knows. Volcanoes are strange things. We really don't understand them at all. Vesuvius in Italy was active for 300 years, until an eruption in 1944, and then it just stopped. It's been silent ever since. Some volcanologists think that it is recharging in a big way, which is a little worrying because 2 million people live on or around it, but nobody knows. And how much warning would you get if Yellowstone was going to go? He shrugged. Nobody was around the last time it blew, so nobody knows what the warning signs are. Probably you would have swarms of earthquakes and some surface uplift and possibly some changes in the patterns of behavior of the geysers and steam vents, but nobody really knows. So it could just blow without warning. He nodded thoughtfully. The trouble, he explained, is that nearly all the things that would constitute warning signs already exist in some measure at Yellowstone. Earthquakes are generally a precursor of volcanic eruptions, but the park already has lots of earthquakes, 1,260 of them last year. Most of them are too small to be felt, but they're earthquakes nonetheless. A change in the pattern of geyser eruptions might also be taken as a clue, he said, but these too vary unpredictably. Once the famous geyser in the park was Excelsior Geyser. It used to erupt regularly and spectacularly to heights of 300 feet, but in 1888 it just stopped. Then, in 1985, it erupted again, though only to a height of 80 feet. Steamboat Geyser is the biggest geyser in the world when it blows, shooting water 400 feet into the air. But the intervals between its eruptions have ranged from as little as 4 days to almost 50 years. If it blew today and again next week, that wouldn't tell us anything at all about what it might do the following week, or the week after, or 20 years from now, Doss says. The whole park is so volatile that it's essentially impossible to draw conclusions from almost anything that happens. Evacuating Yellowstone would never be easy. The park gets some 3 million visitors a year, mostly in the 3 peak months of summer. The park's roads are comparatively few, and they are kept intentionally narrow, partly to slow traffic, partly to preserve an air of picturesqueness, and partly because of topographical constraints. At the height of summer, it can easily take half a day to cross the park and hours to get anywhere within it. Whenever people see animals, they just stop, wherever they are, Doss says. We get bear jams, we get bison jams, we get wolf jams. In the autumn of 2000, representatives from the U.S. Geological Survey and National Park Service, along with some academics, met and formed something called the Yellowstone Volcanic Observatory. 4 such bodies were in existence already in Hawaii, California, Alaska, and Washington, but oddly, none in the largest volcanic zone in the world. The YVO is not actually a thing, but more an idea, an agreement to coordinate efforts at studying and analyzing the park's diverse geology. One of their first tasks, Doss told me, was to draw up an earthquake and volcano hazards plan, a plan of action in the event of a crisis. There isn't one already, I said. No, afraid not. But there will be soon. Isn't that just a little tardy? He smiled. Well, let's just say that it's not any too soon. Once it is in place, the idea is that 3 people, Christensen in Menlo Park, California, Professor Robert B. Smith at the University of Utah, and Doss in the park, would assess the degree of danger of any potential cataclysm and advise the park superintendent. The superintendent would take the decision whether to evacuate the park. As for surrounding areas, there are no plans. If Yellowstone were going to blow in a really big way, you would be on your own once you left the park gates. Of course, it may be tens of thousands of years before that day comes. Doss thinks such a day may not come at all. Just because there was a pattern in the past doesn't mean that it still holds true, he says. There is some evidence to suggest that the pattern may be a series of catastrophic explosions, then a long period of quiet. We may be in that now. The evidence now is that most of the magma chamber is cooling and crystallizing. It is releasing its volatiles. You need to trap volatiles for an explosive eruption. In the meantime, there are plenty of other dangers in and around Yellowstone, as was made devastatingly evident on the night of August 17, 1959, at a place called Hebgen Lake, just outside the park. At 22 minutes to midnight on that date, Hebgen Lake suffered a catastrophic quake. It was magnitude 7.5, not vast, as earthquakes go, but so abrupt and wrenching that it collapsed an entire mountainside. It was the height of the summer season, though fortunately not so many people went to Yellowstone in those days as now. 80 million tons of rock, moving at more than 100 miles an hour, just fell off the mountain, travelling with such force and momentum that the leading edge of the landslide ran 400 feet up a mountain on the other side of the valley. Along its path lay part of the Rock Creek campground. 28 campers were killed, 19 of them buried too deep ever to be found again. The devastation was swift, but heartbreakingly fickle. Three brothers, sleeping in one tent, were spared. Their parents, sleeping in another tent beside them, were swept away and never seen again. "A big earthquake, and I mean big, will happen sometime," Doss told me. "You can count on that. This is a big fault zone for earthquakes." Despite the Hebgen Lake quake and the other known risks, Yellowstone didn't get permanent seismometers until the 1970s. If you needed a way to appreciate the grandeur and inexorable nature of geologic processes, you could do worse than to consider the Tetons, the sumptuously jagged range that stands just to the south of Yellowstone National Park. 9 million years ago, the Tetons didn't exist. The land around Jackson Hole was just a high, grassy plain. But then a 40-mile-long fault opened within the earth, and since then, about once every 900 years, the Tetons experience a really big earthquake, enough to jerk them another 6 feet higher. It is these repeated jerks over eons that have raised them to their present majestic heights of 7,000 feet. That 900 years is an average, and a somewhat misleading one. According to Robert B. Smith and Lee J. Siegel in Windows into the Earth, A Geological History of the Region, the last major Teton quake was somewhere between about 5,000 and 7,000 years ago. The Tetons, in short, are about the most overdue earthquake zone on the planet. Hydrothermal explosions are also a significant risk. They can happen any time, pretty much anywhere, and without any predictability. "You know, by design, we funnel visitors into thermal basins," Doss told me after we had watched Old Faithful blow. "It's what they come to see. Did you know there are more geysers and hot springs at Yellowstone than in all the rest of the world combined?" "I didn't know that." He nodded. 10,000 of them. And nobody knows when a new vent might open. We drove to a place called Duck Lake, a body of water a couple of hundred yards across. "It looks completely innocuous," he said. "It's just a big pond. But this big hole didn't used to be here. At some time in the last 15,000 years, this blew in a really big way. You'd have had several tens of millions of tons of earth and rock and superheated water blowing out at hypersonic speeds. You can imagine what it would be like if this happened under, say, the parking lot at Old Faithful or one of the visitors' centers." He made an unhappy face. "Would there be any warning?" "Probably not. The last significant explosion in the park was at a place called Pork Chop Geyser in 1989. That left a crater about 5 meters across, not huge by any means, but big enough if you happened to be standing there at the time. Fortunately, nobody was around, so nobody was hurt, but that happened without warning. In the very ancient past, there have been explosions that have made holes a mile across, and nobody can tell you where or when that might happen again. You just have to hope that you're not standing there when it does." Big rockfalls are also a danger. There was a big one at Gardner Canyon in 1999, but again, fortunately, no one was hurt. Late in the afternoon, Doss and I stopped at a place where there was a rock overhang poised above a busy park road. Cracks were clearly visible. It could go at any time, Doss said thoughtfully. You're kidding, I said. There wasn't a moment when there weren't two cars passing beneath it, all filled with, in the most literal sense, happy campers. Oh, it's not likely, he added. I'm just saying it could. Equally, it could stay like that for decades. There's just no telling. People have to accept that there is risk in coming here. That's all there is to it. As we walked back to his vehicle to head back to Mammoth Hot Springs, Doss added, But the thing is, most of the time bad things don't happen. Rocks don't fall. Earthquakes don't occur. New vents don't suddenly open up. For all the instability, it's mostly remarkably and amazingly tranquil. Like Earth itself, I remarked. Precisely, he agreed. The risks at Yellowstone apply to park employees as much as to visitors. Doss got a horrific sense of that in his first week on the job 5 years earlier. Late one night, three young summer employees engaged in an illicit activity known as hot potting, swimming or basking in warm pools. Though the park, for obvious reasons, doesn't publicize it, not all the pools in Yellowstone are dangerously hot. Some are extremely agreeable to lie in, and it was the habit of some of the summer employees to have a dip late at night, even though it was against the rules to do so. Foolishly, the threesome had failed to take a flashlight, which was extremely dangerous, because much of the soil around the warm pools is crusty and thin, and one can easily fall through into a scalding vent below. In any case, as they made their way back to their dorm, they came across a stream that they had had to leap over earlier. They backed up a few paces, linked arms, and on the count of three took a running jump. In fact, it wasn't the stream at all. It was a boiling pool. In the dark, they had lost their bearings. None of the three survived. I thought about this the next morning as I made a brief call on my way out of the park at a place called Emerald Pool in the upper Geyser Basin. Doss hadn't had time to take me there the day before, but I thought I ought at least to have a look at it, for Emerald Pool is a historic site. In 1965, a husband and wife team of biologists named Thomas and Louise Brock, while on a summer study trip, had done a crazy thing. They had scooped up some of the yellowy-brown scum that rimmed the pool and examined it for life. To their, and eventually the wider world's, deep surprise, it was full of living microbes. They had found the world's first extremophiles, organisms that could live in water that had previously been assumed to be much too hot or acid or choked with sulfur to bear life. Emerald Pool, remarkably, was all these things, yet at least two types of living things, Sulfolobus acidocaldarius and Thermophilus aquaticus, as they became known, found it congenial. It had always been supposed that nothing could survive above temperatures of 50 degrees centigrade, 122 degrees Fahrenheit. But here were organisms basking in rank, acidic waters nearly twice that hot. For almost 20 years, one of the Brock's two new bacteria, Thermophilus aquaticus, remained a laboratory curiosity, until a scientist in California named Carey B. Mullis realized that heat-resistant enzymes within it could be used to create a bit of chemical wizardry known as a polymerase chain reaction, which allows scientists to generate lots of DNA from very small amounts, as little as a single molecule in ideal conditions. It's a kind of genetic photocopying, and it became the basis for all subsequent genetic science, from academic studies to police forensic work. It won Mullis the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993. Meanwhile, scientists were finding even hardier microbes, now known as hyperthermophiles, which demand temperatures of 80 degrees centigrade, 176 degrees Fahrenheit, or more. The warmest organism found so far, according to Francis Ashcroft in Life at the Extremes, is Pyrolobus fumarii, which dwells in the walls of ocean vents, where the temperature can reach 113 degrees centigrade, 235.4 degrees Fahrenheit. The upper limit for life is thought to be about 120 degrees centigrade, 248 degrees Fahrenheit, though no one actually knows. At all events, the Brock's findings completely changed our perception of the living world. As NASA scientist Jay Bergstrahl has put it, wherever we go on Earth, even into what seemed like the most hostile possible environments for life, as long as there is liquid water and some source of chemical energy, we find life. Life, it turns out, is infinitely more clever and adaptable than anyone had ever supposed. This is a very good thing, for as we are about to see, we live in a world that doesn't altogether seem to want us here. Part 5. Life Itself. The more I examine the universe and study the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe in some sense must have known we were coming. Freeman Dyson. 16. Lonely Planet. It isn't easy being an organism. In the whole universe, as far as we yet know, there is only one place, an inconspicuous outpost of the Milky Way called Earth, that will sustain you, and even it can be pretty grudging. From the bottom of the deepest ocean trench to the top of the highest mountain, the zone that covers nearly the whole of known life is only something over a dozen miles. Not much when set against the ruminous of the cosmos at large. For humans, it is even worse, because we happen to belong to the portion of living things that took the rash but venturesome decision 400 million years ago to crawl out of the seas and become land-based and oxygen-breathing. In consequence, no less than 99.5% of the world's habitable space by volume, according to one estimate, is fundamentally, in practical terms completely, off-limits to us. It isn't simply that we can't breathe in water, but that we couldn't bear the pressures. Because water is about 1,300 times heavier than air, pressures rise swiftly as you descend, by the equivalent of one atmosphere for every 10 meters, 33 feet, of depth. On land, if you rose to the top of a 500-foot eminence, Cologne Cathedral or the Washington Monument, say, the change in pressure would be so slight as to be indiscernible. At the same depth underwater, however, your veins would collapse and your lungs would compress to the approximate dimensions of a Coke can. Amazingly, people do voluntarily dive to such depths, without breathing apparatus, for the fun of it, in a sport known as free diving. Apparently, the experience of having your internal organs rudely deformed is thought exhilarating, though not presumably as exhilarating as having them return to their former dimensions upon resurfacing. To reach such depths, however, divers must be dragged down, and quite briskly, by weights. Without assistance, the deepest anyone has gone and lived to talk about it afterward was an Italian named Umberto Pellizzari, who in 1992 dove to a depth of 236 feet, lingered for a nanosecond, and then shot back to the surface. In terrestrial terms, 236 feet is just slightly over the length of one New York City block, so even in our most exuberant stunts we can hardly claim to be masters of the abyss. Other organisms do, of course, manage to deal with the pressures at depth, though quite how some of them do so is a mystery. The deepest point in the ocean is the Mariana Trench in the Pacific. There, some 7 miles down, the pressures rise to over 16,000 pounds per square inch. We have managed once, briefly, to send humans to that depth in a sturdy diving vessel, yet it is home to colonies of amphipods, a type of crustacean similar to shrimp but transparent, which survive without any protection at all. Most oceans are, of course, much shallower, but even at the average ocean depth of 2.5 miles, the pressure is equivalent to being squashed beneath a stack of 14 loaded cement trucks. Nearly everyone, including the authors of some popular books on oceanography, assumes that the human body would crumple under the immense pressures of the deep ocean. In fact, this appears not to be the case. Because we are made largely of water ourselves, and water is virtually incompressible, in the words of Francis Ashcroft of Oxford University, the body remains at the same pressure as the surrounding water, and is not crushed at depth. It is the gases inside your body, particularly in the lungs, that cause the problem. These do compress, though at what point the compression becomes fatal is not known. Until quite recently, it was thought that anyone diving to 100 meters or so would die painfully as his or her lungs imploded or chest wall collapsed. But the free divers have repeatedly proved otherwise. It appears, according to Ashcroft, that humans may be more like whales and dolphins than had been expected. Plenty else can go wrong, however. In the days of diving suits, the sort that were connected to the surface by long hoses, divers sometimes experienced a dreaded phenomenon known as the squeeze. This occurred when the surface pumps failed, leading to a catastrophic loss of pressure in the suit. The air would leave the suit with such violence that the hapless diver would be, all too literally, sucked up into the helmet and hose pipe. When hauled to the surface, "All that is left in the suit are his bones and some rags of flesh," the biologist J.B.S. Haldane wrote in 1947, adding for the benefit of doubters, "This has happened." Incidentally, the original diving helmet, designed in 1823 by an Englishman named Charles Dean, was intended not for diving, but for firefighting. It was called a smoke helmet, but being made of metal, it was hot and cumbersome, and, as Dean soon discovered, firefighters had no particular eagerness to enter burning structures in any form of attire, but most especially not in something that heated up like a kettle and made them clumsy into the bargain. In an attempt to save his investment, Dean tried it underwater, and found it was ideal for salvage work. The real terror of the deep, however, is the bends. Not so much because they are unpleasant, though of course they are, as because they are so much more likely. The air we breathe is 80% nitrogen. Put the human body under pressure, and that nitrogen is transformed into tiny bubbles that migrate into the blood and tissues. If the pressure is changed too rapidly, as with a too quick ascent by a diver, the bubbles trapped within the body will begin to fizz in exactly the manner of a freshly opened bottle of champagne, clogging tiny blood vessels, depriving cells of oxygen, and causing pain so excruciating that sufferers are prone to bend double in agony, hence the bends. The bends have been an occupational hazard for sponge and pearl divers since time immemorial, but didn't attract much attention in the Western world until the 19th century, and then it was among people who didn't get wet at all, or at least not very wet, and not generally much above the ankles. They were caisson workers. Caissons were enclosed dry chambers built on riverbeds to facilitate the construction of bridge piers. They were filled with compressed air, and often, when the workers emerged after an extended period of working under this artificial pressure, they experienced mild symptoms like tingling or itchy skin. But an unpredictable few felt more insistent pain in the joints, and occasionally collapsed in agony, sometimes never to get up again. It was almost puzzling. Sometimes workers would go to bed feeling fine, but wake up paralyzed. Sometimes they wouldn't wake up at all. Ashcroft relates a story concerning the directors of a new tunnel under the Thames who held a celebratory banquet as the tunnel neared completion. To their consternation, their champagne failed to fizz when uncorked in the compressed air of the tunnel. However, when at length they emerged into the fresh air of a London evening, the bubbles sprang instantly to fizziness, memorably enlivening the digestive process. Apart from avoiding high-pressure environments altogether, only two strategies are reliably successful against the bends. The first is to suffer only a very short exposure to the changes in pressure. That is why the free divers I mentioned earlier can descend to depths of 500 feet without ill effect. They don't stay under long enough for the nitrogen in their system to dissolve into their tissues. The other solution is to ascend by careful stages. This allows the little bubbles of nitrogen to dissipate harmlessly. A great deal of what we know about surviving at extremes is owed to the extraordinary father and son team of John Scott and J.B.S. Haldane. Even by the demanding standards of British intellectuals, the Haldanes were outstandingly eccentric. The senior Haldane was born in 1860 to an aristocratic Scottish family. His brother was Viscount Haldane, but spent most of his career in comparative modesty as a professor of physiology at Oxford. He was famously absent-minded. Once, after his wife had sent him upstairs to change for a dinner party, he failed to return and was discovered asleep in bed in his pyjamas. When roused, Haldane explained that he had found himself disrobing and assumed it was bedtime. His idea of a vacation was to travel to Cornwall to study hookworm in minors. Aldous Huxley, the novelist grandson of T.H. Huxley, who lived with the Haldanes for a time, parodied him a touch mercilessly as the scientist Edward Tantamount in the novel Point Counterpoint. Haldane's gift to diving was to work out the rest intervals necessary to manage an ascent from the depths without getting the bends. But his interests ranged across the whole of physiology, from studying altitude sickness in climbers to the problems of heat stroke in desert regions. He had a particular interest in the